And Lena Life is back. I'm Lena Mirmont with my very special, would say charming guests, who in spite of his tremendous elegance, is very successful in the business world. And we're going to discuss his book and things which are really also beyond the book, regarding the strategy of fundraising. The name of my guest is Mark Pittman. Mark, how are you? You're most welcome to all of us.
Well, thank you so much, Lena. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, we are going to start perhaps with a little unusual opening. And that will describe, forgive me for my position, reaction regarding your book. because it is, as I said, more than just an elegant, extremely friendly, beautifully done, not only because it's not heavy in weight, but extremely resourceful in information. And before I will go into the book, which we all dying to go to, I like to describe the a little extra addition which came with the book. It's a bow tie, which is made out of paper. And I will be terribly embarrassing myself, but confessing to you that I thought it is a novelty which has to do with the paper pin. And I thought that I can put it in one of my clothes and just proudly say that this is one of my, yes, one of my guests' novelty. And I also felt that this it's done so eloquently with a shape of small hearts, so it applies to can be very sentimental, so a woman can use it as well. So all of these fantasies, which really didn't serve me properly, been aging until my son, who also is my producer, turned this bow tie in the opposite side, and he informed me that indeed this is a business card.
I love marketing, and I've worn when I told my fans and my customers and people that knew me about 10 years ago when I started fundraisingcoach.com, I asked them, what do you think of when you think of me? One of the questions I asked, because it was going to be a personal brand. And they said coffee and bow ties. So that has always been a part of who I am. It wasn't until I was at a social media breakfast in Maine, and there was I was talking with some people from a branding firm called Pulp and, I think it's Pulp and Wire in Portland, Maine. They said, well, I had mood cards. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're a little sliver business cards, which are very, you could pack a lot in your bag. They're different. They stand out. I had a picture of me with a bow tie on one of them. And she said, you have a bow tie. Your business card has a bow tie. Your website has a bow tie. Why are your business cards not cut out like bow ties? And the beauty of this, Lena, is that people, just like the Pulp and Wire people said, people at conferences now hold them up and take pictures of themselves, or they go home and take pictures of themselves with it, or their dogs with it, or they put it in their hair like a bow in their hair. And then they email me their pictures or just put it on Facebook or Google Plus. So I have all this social media positive reinforcement of social, they call it social proof. Other people are liking my stuff. And so they're able to, they told me, I ran another contest. I said, what do you call it? I've been what? And they all said marked, M-A-R-C apostrophe D. So when they get a bow tie, you can now say, Lena, that you've been marked. And if you want to send me an email with a picture, you can. I'd be glad to post it.
Oh, I will be delighted to have this fantastic exposure. And I have to say that this is just a lovely little brook to get into your book, because after I recover from your bow tie, I decided finally to get into your book. And I like to do something which I think will be one of the most truthful and genuine introduction of your book. And then after that, certainly we will talk a little bit about your background. Basically, I will ask you to talk a little bit about your background and to have this a little bit of a mystery where you would be able to address very heavy, substantial problems of business and fundraising into very transparent, extremely accessible, very professional, and yet very clear picture with a promise and give us all this opening for success. So I like to... I like just to get into the beginning, and this is table of contents. And that, frankly, made my soul speak more than my mind because it is so organic. It's extremely clear and very short. I'm going to read it literally from your table of contents titles, yes, which will, I think, will make a certain guidelines and orientation and give immediate plan how your book is written, what we will be talking about, and you will be the judge of making certain major points and some perhaps some subtle comments. So the chapter number one is research. Chapter number two is engage. Chapter number three is ask. Chapter number four, love. In the middle of the book, we will be talking about love. And then you go into some technical descriptions, which I found extremely helpful. Seven fundraising myths. Put yourself in their shoes. Tools for knowing your donors. And then summary and resources, which obviously extremely useful as well. So this is the content of the book. And I will ask you a general question. Perhaps, what did you feel you accomplished, the most important points regarding your book?
Haven't been asked that before. It's a good question. The reason I wrote the book was I had a decade of very successful fundraising and took an opportunity to move back to my family's homestead in Maine, up here in New England, and found that a lot of people in this rural state couldn't afford to hire me to do what I do well, which is both I'm really good at asking people for money and I'm really good at teaching people to get excited about asking. So I think the main thing that I accomplished with the book was hiring a person to train you is expensive. Coaching is less expensive, but it's still an investment. But a $15 book was something that most anybody can pick up and learn from. And the reason I was really intrigued that you picked up on how small it was, or that it was. I like that you put elegant or something in weight. I only wanted to put things in there that would inspire and equip, this, particularly volunteers, to ask for money. Because there are so many wonderful boards and nonprofits that are run by board members that just need a little bit of training. If they just had a little bit more knowledge about asking, they could actually do so much more good in the world. So I wanted to make it so that it was something that they could pick up, but people wouldn't be intimidated by. They'd be able to read in one sitting if they wanted to, or on one airplane ride, and then they could be off to the races, making the world a better place even more effectively.
Well, this is certainly somewhat already the answer because you explained this in a, such a natural way, which really does relate to real life. And I think I neglected and didn't present the title of a book very clearly. I like to say it again, because that will be based for my next question. Ask without fear. And I like also to attach to the title one thing which impressed me very deeply. There are some people who have their own very high position, corporate people and people in the different areas, including even artistic world, made not just general favoriting comments, they truly reacted to the quality and to the problems which you made, again, so clear, so crisp, and so transparent. One of the comments actually came even from the person who is director of development of Sarasota Opera in Sarasota. The reason I'm making that point is because the resourcefulness of your book is just absolutely endless. So let me ask you this question. How would you categorize the basic general classic rules of fundraising, number one? And then looking a little bit to the next question, how one would be able to adapt it to its own individual side of the business? So let's come back to the first part. What would you say is a really classic, basic questions people have to ask themselves with the full honesty?
Well, I think where fundraising, the basic, and again, your way of asking questions is really interesting because it's drawing out different answers than I might normally say, but really at its basis is that human beings, by and large, tend to be generous. People like to give and help and support and make the world a better place. They tend to. Nonprofits are notoriously bad at asking. And so people get turned off by bad asking. Most nonprofits tend to come at fundraising from a place of scarcity and negativity because they didn't get into this thing to ask for money. They want to create art. They want to feed people. They want to save land. They want to protect pets and educate kids. They don't want to have to ask people for money. That's either beneath them. There's all these negative emotions that people have with money. And then that comes across in the fundraising, almost to the point of donors are a bother. They're a pain in the neck. If they just get out of my way and let me do my art, it would be so much better. And so I think one of the basic rules of fundraising is that we get the privilege of meeting people at their basic generosity. We get to explore with people, whether it's mailings of thousands of people at a time or one-on-one over coffee. We get to explore with people their values. What is it that they want to, what's the stamp they want to leave on the world? What's the difference that they want to make? And we get to find ways with them, with our organizations, our nonprofits, that may connect with their values. And it sounds pie in the sky when you put it that way, but that's really what it is. When you've asked somebody for $100,000 and they get excited because they can make the difference that you're inviting them to make, it gets addicting. You want to do it again and again and again. It's really fun.
Your chapter, it's a chapter to engage, I think relates quite a bit to what you've been just talking about. Am I right?
Yes. Okay. So part of the way I summarize asking for money because it's so scary for people, I tried to use a phrase called get real. I'm a Gen Xer. I grew up hearing get real a lot. And it's a double entendre. The first meaning of get real is just, it's a simple acronym. R is research. You need to research your cause. Usually when I ask people how much they want to raise, they don't know. They say more is better. I had one gentleman who has three different nonprofits successfully been running them for 20 years. They said, what do you need to raise? It took them 20 minutes to answer the question because some of their revenue was from ticket sales and some of the revenues were their all different pots, but he didn't know what he was actually trying to raise. So first we need to research our project. Then we need to research our donors. Then we need to engage them, the E stands for engage. We need to get to know them. The A stands for ask. We have to ask them. The people aren't going to give. They're not going to figure out they need to give. They need to be asked. And then the L stands for loving them, whether they say yes or no. People are always more worth more than the amount of money that they can give to our cause. They always have, human beings have innate worth. And we need to, it's easy to forget that in fundraising, but we need to encourage people to remember that. So that's why I did Get Real at first. But the second part, as I've been teaching it, right now I have a private one-on-one coaching. And right now I'm doing, all of my clients are introvert task-centered people. If you know the DISC personality theory, D-I-S-C, they're all C's. And it's, the Get Real also works for them because so many people feel like they have to become something they're not if they're going to be successful at fundraising. They think they have to be a fast-pitched kind of salesman, smarmy sort of schemer that has a spiel that they're going to be able to say the right words at the right moment and manipulate someone into giving. And it's not that at all. They just need to get real. They be themselves. Sharing their story is far more effective at whatever pace they are than remembering all the different tactics and phrases and statistics of your organization and whatever. It's just taking a deep breath and being yourself is the most effective way to do fundraising.
I totally find you, again, it's a continuation of being truly very real. What you're saying, it's very logical, and it looks as if it is a product of your experience.
Definitely.
I like to, before I will ask a little heavier question, I was very moved by some of your decisions of putting sayings of other famous people. For example, Anna Frank said, no one has ever become poor by giving.
Mm.
It's in your chapter number 3, Ask. Frankly, there are other sayings just so moving and just departuring a little bit from my next question. I like to congratulate you for a better word, that you brought a lot of human juice to your book, and it's a promise. Yes, it's a promise not only in your obvious wisdom and experience, but it's a promise that it is doable, that it is not only in the hands of huge corporations who are just moving huge tons of bricks and cement. This is fantastic. Now, I'd like to ask you a little heavier question.
Sure.
It is unfortunate that we're living in times where computer mentality of the exchanges, all this brief, quick, sometimes super technical, superficial communications really took place of quality exchanges. There is no secret about that. And I found that there is a threat where certain even simple tasks became impossible because it became norm not to return calls. It became norm not to return emails. It's even became very normal to have a lot of fraudulent activities on the internet and all other, as I call it, non-quality competition. How do you handle our modern reality and where the weather vane is going to be in fundraising?
Hmm. Wow. Well, first of all, I love the age we live in. I think this is the most exciting time that I'm sure whatever time I was in, I'd probably think was exciting, but I feel so blessed to have been chosen to participate in the world as it is now. For the first time, at least for my clients and for small business people too, I'm a solopreneur. I was an employee that wrote a book and started speaking and spun off to be my own business. We have the most, with all the connections that we have an ability to live in the most beautiful places in the world, like I do in rural Maine, and still have a global impact in a way that most of our forebears could never imagine. The issues of people not responding to each other or not, there are always rude people, and rudeness goes both ways. When I'm working with nonprofits, oftentimes the reason people don't respond to emails or calls or don't return them could be that they're just rude. That's fine. There are some, but sometimes I find that we're not communicating with people the way they want to be communicated with. I had one development director thank me for a donation that I made to her nonprofit by a chat on Google Chat. She happened to notice that I was using Gmail, and she just pinged me with this little, I don't even do instant messaging. I didn't know that was on, but she just chatted, "Hey, thanks so much for your gift. We just got it. You know, we just processed it and it made me smile. Thank you." I have other friends and colleagues that will only respond to texts when I text them. They'll never respond to an email. So you have to figure out, it's a pain in the neck, but it's worth it because it helps us accomplish our goals and our objectives if we learn how people like to respond to things. Some people love, well, here's another one. From a business perspective, I wrote the book because I'm a book reader. I like books, so I wanted to write a book for people. I didn't realize until after I wrote the book that most Americans don't read more than one book a year. I read 50 to 75 a year. So I'm not the norm. Most Americans and people, a lot of people too, just around the world, like to have video, visual teaching. So it took me over 2 years to finally get into a studio and create an Ask Without Fear DVD with me on camera talking to people so that they could take this to their boards and to their staff and accomplish the goal of getting great information out there at a lower cost. But I never even thought of a DVD. Who wants to see me in my bow tie? Why don't they just read the book? So part of it, I think, that we need to do is try to figure out different ways to interact with people. And some of that can be just human dynamics. If you're in Ask Without Fear, I have a whole book on interpersonal relationships. And if you're talking to someone and you notice that they're talking really fast like I do, and you're not naturally a fast talker, you might want to speed up your talk if you're asking them for money. If they're a slower talker and you're a very fast talker, you may come across to them as dishonest. They may think that you're talking really fast because you're trying to cover something up. So it's just better to take a breath, slow yourself down, and try to match the style that they're talking, the speed they're talking at. Same thing with email. With one of my clients, actually, and a good friend, he doesn't respond to emails. Even though he asked me to email him, I know if I really need a response, I just need to text him, and he'll immediately text right back. So there's just, we need to, part of, I guess, the annoyance of this age is that there are so many different ways to communicate that we have to, that there's no one-size-fits-all for people. But I love that because that allows us to expand our impact even more.
I am totally amazed because I believe that we have to have a digital x-rays with a little bit drop of psychology into it. And I'm not sure if a lot of people who have certain one-side gift can polarize themselves and have that analytical and quick making process judgment. That's why we all need you, because you have it all. You can compartmentalize this, and it is just fascinating what you said. I have to announce again for someone who just joined us. I have a truly delightful time along with my local listeners here in East Coast with, I'm sure, New Englanders of Mark Pittman, that we have this conversation, and he is true specialist and intuitive leader of the process for the fundraising. He is a coach who can channel just about any business and to find its tremendous strength, perhaps some deficiencies which every business has, but has this instant ability to compensate and to bring this fundraising to most glorious success and efficiency. I like to talk a little bit about your background, Mark, which is so colorful. It is different points and experiences in your education, from Regent University to Jerusalem University College, to Gordon College of Massachusetts and Milton Academy of Massachusetts, which I am a little bit familiar with. And also, I'm so thrilled for you that you found your physical and spiritual home in Maine. Of course, the whole surroundings of Maine is so magnificent, and refinement of historic values of New England certainly, I'm sure, helping you to get the least of the stress which we get here in New York, and the most of the productivity which you get with your birds and trees. So, saying that, I like to follow your next chapter, and that's get real love. Of course, one of the first thoughts of Oprah Winfrey, which says basically that it is very important to appreciate what you have, because if you're only concentrating on what you do not have, you never will have what you want to have. And also, there are some other very deep, profound thoughts of people who are reinforcing philosophical nature of your book. So my next question will be, perhaps with a little bit of a personal touch, why about love in a business book?
Well, first of all, people can, if they want to see all the quotes, clearly they can buy the book. That would be great. But if they don't want to, I've also added some new quotes to it on my website at fundraisingcoach.com/quotes, Q-U-O-T-E-S. They're all there, too, in their categories that you're talking about them, with some new ones that people keep suggesting new ones, which is wonderful. Wrote about love because one of the problems that I really disliked in some of the places I'd worked in fundraising was a sense of entitlement. There was a sense of, we're doing holy work as nonprofits. We're not in it for the filthy lucre. We're not in it for profit. So people owe us. They owe us their gifts. In fact, the people that are just running businesses are somehow less spiritual and a lower order of being, and we are better than that. I just couldn't stand it. It goes against my own spiritual, my faith tradition, and it just went against all sense of propriety. So when I was thinking about, in traditional fundraising they talk about cultivating the gift, sort of like tending the soil, solicitation, doing the ask or harvesting, and then stewardship, stewarding the donor, thanking them. But I wanted to make it a little bit more stark and make it love because, as my friend Tom Ahern, who's an amazing fundraising letter writer and just a great, great person, says that if your mission depends on donor support, then you need to put donors into your mission. And I think if we really, truly were great, express gratitude for our donors, we'd start putting them into if we truly love them, they'd be part of our mission statement, as our, whatever the organization is. Because if we didn't, they need to be part of our mission. And so that was just part of the reason I chose love. And I also did it because I like being a little bit of a contrarian, and I thought it would tweak some of the people that I wanted to really reach. I thought it would make them look twice. Most people that don't get it think fundraising is a business transaction, is a cold, mechanical, you know, signing of checks or giving of money or get, you know, withdrawals from a bank account, or even worse, pickpocketing or mugging people. I knew that there's a specific subset of people that would see that, and either be, or hopefully have their curiosity piqued, because I think we need to be reminded that we're dealing with human beings. And even if they say no, here's where I go, Lena. One of the things that is amazing in nonprofit world and business, there's a part in sales where you need numbers. You need people. The more approaches you make, the more sales statistically you will eventually make. And so if someone says no, sales training typically tells you to, I remember seeing this guy on a stage with a hard hat and a toilet bowl handle on the side and a sound chip in it. So he said, and if they tell you no, just flush them and move on. And that's not what it's about at all with nonprofit fundraising. It's not, we don't live in a scarcity. We don't need to live in a scarcity mentality. People, like I said before, have a far more innate worth than just the amount of money they can give you. So if you handle their no well, you set yourself apart. So many nonprofits, when they ask for money and the donor says no, they either take it personally and get offended. What? Are we not good enough for you? Whatever. I mean, it's just the no is not often isn't about the nonprofit itself. It's about the donor's ability to give or psychic ability to give. They may have as much money as they did 5 years ago, but they feel like they have less. So they psychically feel like they can't give. But if you handle that no well and maintain the relationship, you will be much closer to their shortlist when it comes back to a time of them feeling like they can give. And so that's what I love. I love having a chapter on love in there, and I love getting to talk about it every time I get to talk about fundraising, because it's during the Occupy protests, I was driving. I almost got into an accident in Portland because I needed to pull the car over really quickly. There was a guy that had a sandwich board on him that was very much what I tell people every time I do a fundraising seminar. It was this man in a raincoat, and it said, his placard said, "I am not your ATM." And that's what I've been telling for years, telling nonprofits that they need to stop treating donors like ATMs. So, love is a definite part of that. And it's on both sides of the ask. The engagement step, I call it, is like dating. So it's getting to know them and letting them get to know about your nonprofit. Well, it's the same on the other end. After they've given the gift, here's a dirty secret in fundraising. Can I share that with you? A dirty secret?
This what exactly I love.
Okay. The dirty little secret in fundraising in the United States anyway is that 70% of donors don't make a second gift to the average nonprofit. So to illustrate this, if any of you that are listening right now are working on a nonprofit or on a board of a nonprofit, and you were to just list out 10 people that gave their first gift to your organization in 2012, you could take a Sharpie and cross out the names of 7 of those people. If you're an average nonprofit, 7 of those people won't give again. An interview I did for a thing called the Donor Retention Project, which is donorretentionjazz.com, there was a man, Adrian Sargent, who was talking about this. But the number one reason they don't give again is they're not thanked. Most nonprofits cash the check, deposit the credit card fee, and move on without even acknowledging the fact that they received a gift, let alone thanking them for the gift and for the investment, or even better still, proving that the investment was a good investment, that the gift was put to good use. We just don't do a good job of communicating.
That's exactly what you just said, not a good job in communicating. And if I can relate this to my previous question, which you answered very clearly with a different way of communication, and you just have to find out and experiment with other person's habits of communication, you touched upon something now purely human. And that's, frankly, I'm particularly very concerned about and very frustrated, because being an artistic field, looking at these young people and, frankly, facing with certain issues in my own field, I'm totally sometimes blown away in a very negative way, because people just in the hands of these millions of tricks, twists and what they've been studying in a business school and all this tremendous competition, which is mounting in the numbers, but not in a true communication. And I think, especially because economy is so tough, that's where this communication and trust should play a greater role, but indeed it plays much lesser role.
Well, and when money is tight, it's easy. Money is amazing. There's a reason that Jesus said you can't serve both God and money. There's an intricate, and from my faith tradition as a Christian, the Hebrew and Christian scriptures did touch on money over 800 times. I won't go deeper into that, but there's a reason for that, and it's because it has a profound impact on us. So when we're sitting in our business or in our nonprofit and the money is not coming in, fear, insecurity, scarcity, all these negative emotions are right beneath the surface of our existence and ready to pounce on us and ready to well up within us. And then we start making really stupid decisions. We start thinking that everybody's out to get us or nobody wants what we have to offer or the fact that that particular nonprofit or that particular entrepreneur is succeeding means that it's taking away from our success. That nonprofit's doing well it's because of them that I'm not getting donors. People are giving to them instead of me, and that's bad. Where in reality, that's not how it is at all. When in reality, and that's where that's one of the things like we need, why I need to have a coach of my own that I talk to, and why I love doing this for others is that we need an outside person to be able to say, look, that's what you're experiencing, but that's not real. The fact that that business or that nonprofit succeeding is actually good for you, because that means there are more people that are buying that sort of service or more people that are being generous. When I worked at a coffee shop, I was told that if one coffee shop goes into a community, into a downtown, that's good. But if the second one comes, most people would say, oh, that's bad, that's competition. It turns out it's better for both downtown businesses that there are two coffee shops, because more people end up thinking about, when they think coffee, they think going downtown. Instead of when there's just one, they may not think about it much at all. But it turns out it doesn't steal business away from the existing one. It actually brings more people to think about coming to the same area, whether it's a strip mall or downtown or wherever it is, to have coffee. So there's a lot more abundance in the world than we remember. And it's very helpful, whether it's through tapes and audio, radio shows like this, whatever it is, it's helpful to be reminded that even though we're living in scarcity and sometimes really dire circumstances, it's temporary. It doesn't have to be the way it always is.
Another example and something which you reminded to me, and I like to move on into your another chapter, but you just reminded, if you remember, when just a rental of movies became so popular, everyone was thinking that movie theaters will go bankrupt. It turned out to be totally opposite. However, another example, not with a happy ending, record companies absolutely disappeared because of the iTunes. So we are dealing, obviously, with a huge magnitude of these businesses, and it is extremely difficult to calculate every detail, and I believe that the bigger business, the more of the strategic points needs to be made, and therefore we will not go to that big area and big businesses. We will stick to your expertise, and I personally very interested in that solar entrepreneurship. And therefore, I like to go into your next chapter, which has to do with the 7 fundraising myths. I was so relieved that there are only 7, not 107.
Well, first of all, I just want to touch on something you mentioned, that, and then I won't dwell there. But one of the neat things, disruption happens, and all circumstances in life. That's just part of life, is disruption. And we can either, you know, grip our hands and try to grit our teeth and try to, like the record companies, try to sue the college students that are doing downloads that they shouldn't be doing, or we can go and try to figure out where in the disruption can we profit? Where can we service other people like Twitter, or where can we profit? Because Twitter isn't really profitable yet, but it's connecting, it's helping helping whole regime change initiatives be organized. So one of the examples is for entrepreneurs, it's a much better time to be alive now than before, and then even 50 years ago, because in some ways, because often larger organizations miss it because they're listening to their own echo chamber of whatever reality they're living in. It wasn't American Express that created emailing money. It was PayPal. That was a market disruption. And now they're trying to play backup to get it done. And so there's a lot of opportunities for nonprofits and entrepreneurs that in small businesses to service a niche really well in a high touch, high tech way that big corporations can't even get. So I'm excited about that.
you got me excited, which is not such a simple task, but thank you.
You're welcome. But the seven myths, yes. Part of what I wanted to do with the seven myths chapter is anybody that's an expert in any business or any field or has done consulting or speaking, they'll often, or just has expertise in a field in their job, like people that have been a development director for years and years, you often get board members and CEOs saying the same things. And you often get some of the same questions. Fundraising. This is very helpful for fundraising. There are usually only between 7 and 10 objections to any fundraising ask. Those objections are different depending on your cause, but you can sit down and with your board or with your team, with your staff, have them all take a pad of Post-its and say, okay, you've just asked somebody, your friend, for more money than you ever thought you could ever ask them for. List all the different reasons they won't give and list one per Post-it note. And then you stick all those reasons up on a wall, and if you combine them, clump them into common themes, you'll generally get 7 to 10 common themes. And then all of a sudden, all those objections become manageable because people in the room know people that are giving anyway. Same thing with sales. If you have a few objections, you can handle them. Well, I didn't want to come heavy-handed, so I called them seven fundraising myths, and I tried to use humor. Because they're pretty prevalent. Like the one I call the Mickey D, about Mickey D, McDonald's, that so many nonprofits think that if they're cheap, the donors are going to be impressed by that. And going to McDonald's for a person, taking a person to lunch and going to McDonald's versus a restaurant with real silverware isn't really necessarily going to impress them, because most people that have assets, have wealth, understand the difference between cheap and a good investment. And I think the story I use in the book is an example of a headmaster at a school I worked at who knew that if the budget line said for his house they needed the cheapest cabinets they could get, he knew if they put the cheapest cabinets in the headmaster's house, they'd have to replace them every year. But he knew that if they got two models up, the model that was two steps better than the cheapest, they'd still be out of budget a little bit, but they wouldn't have to replace them for 4 or 5 years. So over the long haul, they'd save money. And that's one of the mistakes. Which of the mistakes, did any of them stick out for you the most?
Honestly, the mistake which I was looking for, I was going to ask you a question. It was helpful more than just because they're just fantastic descriptions of all this myth. I like the highway fallacy. Maybe you can share that.
Sure. But so many people, particularly in the DIS personality system, it's the Ds. They're the dominant drivers. They're the extroverts who are task-centered, tend to be very much, their leadership style tends to be, we're going to do it and we're going to do it my way. Yes. And so often where they those people get in trouble, they tend to be founders of nonprofits, is that they just say, you know, the heck with you, I'm going to ask my way, and I'm not going to, you know, I don't care if you like to get texts, I don't do texting, so I'm just going to give you a phone call, even though I know you'll never answer the phone. Or I don't care if you're interested in giving to this particular program at our nonprofit, I'm asking for another one, I'm going to keep asking, I'm not going to shape up anyway at all. But the thing is, I guess the trick is, and I wrote a chapter on this too, is PYITS, PYITS, I call it. Put yourself in their shoes.
Yes, it's the next. Yes, thank you for going into it. That's exactly connected to the what you're talking about. Sorry, interrupting you, but I'm.
That's great, because it's amazing how helpful it is to take a step back. We get so into our own details. If we take a step back and put ourselves in their shoes, how would it feel to be on the receiving end of this email? Would it seem helpful and honoring, or would it seem demanding and whining? The example I use in the book is that there's a nonprofit who helped families work with their credit. And they repaired credit and helped people rebuild their lives. And they're just a wonderful organization. In their direct mail appeals, they had chosen, because of the nature of their work, they didn't want their name on the envelope. There are some studies that show that if you don't have a return address on the envelope, you get a better open rate. You have to test that for yourself. But they had decided they weren't going to put their name on the envelope. So it's to not embarrass people, but in their email and their annual appeal, they developed this wonderful story about a family who had their credit denied and how they were able to help repair them. And it was to inspire donors to give more so that they could help more families. So they put in this red stamp on the letter that said credit denied. That became the name of this particular fundraising package or mailing, a direct mail package. Then, as good direct mail is, they put that same theme on the front of the letter. So they had the person's address, and off to the left of it at an angle, they had a red stamp that said credit denied. Well, all it would have taken was somebody in an office just before they sent it to the print house saying, wait a minute, let me put myself in their shoes. How would it feel if I went to my mailbox, opened up my mail, flipped through things, and saw this white envelope with my name on it and the stamp credit denied? They would have saved them a lot of angst. I found out about this story in an email list of colleagues on a site called Charity Channel back 10 years ago, 5 years after the mailing, and there were still people that had dropped, they had stopped giving to this organization. They caused so much anger from their donor base because they hadn't put themselves in their shoes. And it could be letters, it could be a phone call, it could be an event, it could be any number of things that you do, but just taking the step back. And sometimes it means removing yourself from your office. Sometimes if you work with a team, it means getting your team off site. And just taking a step and looking at things from a new perspective can do you a world of good and save you a lot of heartache. I just got finished re-editing a book. My sixth book is on social media, and I had written it and put it in and published it for a class I was teaching at a university. But a friend of mine actually took the time to read it and noticed, you know, she almost every page had some sort of grammatical change that needed to be made. I hadn't taken this. I was too close to it. I couldn't take a step back, and I needed an outside person to help with that one. But putting yourself in their shoes is just can save a lot of heartache and a lot of arjita, and keep goodwill, keep goodwill going for your organization and your effort.
Absolutely. Actually, it made me think also that you really have to have a dialogue with yourself. The better you know yourself, the better you know your shortcomings, the better you know where your ego is somewhat more than you want it to be, the better probably your communication with your board or your colleagues will be, and the better, obviously, the more open channel of communication you will have, and understanding where other people coming from, just exactly what you were talking about.
And well, yes, because if you know yourself better, I firmly believe that the better we each know ourselves and our hardwiring and our natural talents, the better we can be in the world, and we'll stop trying to be everything to everybody, because we can't be. So that's why I love DISC. I love Myers-Briggs. There's a wonderful abilities battery called the Highlands Ability Battery that actually time limits your test. So it actually tests you on how you perform on seemingly inane tasks. And from that draws out 19 hardwired driving talents of yours. But Gallup Strengths Finder is good. There's a whole bunch of things out there, but it all goes back to it gives us a bit of humility to realize we can't be everything to everyone. And if we just were a little bit more humble in our approach, bold, excited, but with a slightly self-deprecating, perhaps, not necessarily, but just the humility to know that I don't see the full picture. I'm going to be as amazingly on fire as I can with what the picture I see right now, but that picture is going to keep getting clearer as I get closer to my destination, and I might need to turn a little bit or change course a little bit to get there. I think that's what came up when you were talking. It seemed like a little bit of a healthy humility will go a long way in whatever interactions you're doing.
Yes, because no matter how much you'll be educated in all this business habits and rules, as we mentioned before, it's unavoidable. And thank God it is unavoidable that we need to deal with ourselves first and then to deal with other people. And we're lucky if we know enough about the people we know, but there's such a thing as a cold connections or cold calls, where we have to be open enough to see and to receive any kinds of information. And the reason I mention this, because reading your book actually opened a lot of different avenues for thinking. It's almost like a double book you're reading, what you express, and then you're creating your own feedback almost instantly. And obviously, unfortunately, we cannot bring all other issues, but one I still try to sneak in our conversation, if you perhaps can classified a certain type of fundraising, and to make this very general question, I will make, hopefully it's a little easier for you. There are some fundraising regarding certain product, certain object, something which people can touch, see, measure, and make marketing research relatively clear. But there are some other fundraising of an abstract things like art, music, some services. Would you have some classification or some perhaps wishes and some ideas? How can we go to something which we don't see, something which we will make people excited about those abstract substances?
So part of it is I'm not a fan of sales, although they have their place, but I'm a fan of philanthropy, which is people giving to the abstract. And part of what we need to do is make it more tangible. We need to break down what it is that we're asking for. What's a day sponsor for the radio station? What's a campership? How much an acre of land would it cost? You know, what are donors giving to? But it's even more coming into what excites us about the cause and trying to ask people, this is what excites me about the cause. What does it excite you? Asking people that have already invested in your nonprofit or have already bought your product, saying, what do you like about what you got? And then using that kind of language when you're sharing that with others. That's something that is so important. And people wanted to, at fundraisingcoach.com, in the articles section, there's a free article on do-it-yourself fundraising that talks about how to kind of organize that together. And there's another one on storytelling that entrepreneurs can use too, called The Rule of Threes, that is a free article up there also that talks about how do you have to think about your perfect ideal client or donor, and then how do you tell your story? What are all the things you're currently doing, not that you hope to do, but you're currently doing? And then the three, you can choose the three that will most likely break through to that person, and then how you communicate it and repeat it. And I think the discipline of consistently, I think people get swayed too much when they ask one person and that person says no. We have studied this since World War II, and for fundraising, you need 3 to 5 prospects for every one gift. So it's 80% rejection. You're going to get a lot of no's. And often those no's are no's at the level you're asking. They're going to be yeses at a lower level, but still, you need to kind of have a tough skin and know, be committed to your mission. And that could be just getting out to where the mission's happening, reminding yourself why you're in it in the first place.
I notice that unnoticeably our time is finished. Perhaps if mutually our times will correlate, we will invite you again, because obviously it was already so much to think about, but immediately implement in life. So I wanted to thank you for your accessibility as a fundraiser coach, as a writer, and as a person. Somehow you managed to put this all together, and I think clearly connecting part is your bow tie. And that is something which certainly I am enjoying to have in my hand, and who knows, maybe I will use it as a pin, because after
nice.
All...
Some people say I tie it all together.
I tie it all together with elegance.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure is ours. And to conclude, I just wanted to make sure that you will give us your website, and then we will come to my final thoughts. Mark, where can we find you, just like I found yourself?
If you Google Mark Pittman or Fundraising Coach, you should find me. My website is fundraisingcoach.com. I have a free newsletter that goes out every 2 weeks on aspects of fundraising. My Twitter handle is Mark A. Pittman, M-A-R-C-A, P as in Peter, I-T-M-A-N.
And I will again say that your book, Ask Without Fear, certainly a fantastic invitation to your another book, which you just mentioned on the air about the media. And particularly personally, thank you for speaking about the people who are more challenged being solo entrepreneur, who are sometimes less fortunate, at least in the short run. And thank you for giving this extremely realistic, wise, and resourceful way for fundraising. That was Mark Pittman. I wish you absolutely the best.
Thank you. Thank you.